From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The tundra will be frozen in Green Bay and in Foxborough, but which of the NFL's Final Four will warm the hearts of fans? The conference championship preview is just ahead on Only a Game. Also, Bob Knight, Nets win number 900, the story of Reggie Bush and those who would profit by him, and a look into the double-secret world of Major League Baseball's brand-new Department of Investigation. Also ahead, indoor caving in Wales.
I've been in a cave before, but I've never been underwater in a tiny cave before.
What do you want to see?
I'm not really sure. I just hope that it's really small and tight and wet. I like it.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
Our players really played hard tonight against a really good team and a really good bunch of kids. But you people here tonight and seats being full for a change made one hell of a difference in the way Texas Tech played.
Thus spoke the head coach of the men's basketball team at Texas Tech, Bob Knight, after the team had provided Knight with his 900th victory on Wednesday night. No coach of a men's team has more wins on his resume. Joining me now to discuss the accomplishments of the occasionally irascible one and various other matters pertaining to college basketball is ESPN.com's Pat Forty. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be here.
All right. Does it surprise you that even in the wake of this milestone victory, Coach Knight could find a way to chide the home fans even while praising them?
Not at all. I say congratulations to Bob Knight with all tepid sincerity on reaching that landmark. But no, that's perfect. That's completely in company with the Bob Knight that we all know and that some people love, myself not being one of them. And you know what it really speaks to, though, beyond just that part of his prickly personality, Bill, is that would never be the case if he had stayed at Indiana, if he hadn't run himself out of the best job he could have possibly had, where the seats are always full, and it's a basketball school, and they would have loved Bob Knight and his accomplishments if he didn't have the fatal flaws that he does in his personality. And instead, that's why he's exiled to basketball Elba, where they really don't care that much, and they only get the full gym once or twice a year. And that is the bed he's made for himself, and now he's lying in it.
Well, prickly nature and exile to Elba notwithstanding, 900 wins is a remarkable feat. And maybe, as you are suggesting, the most impressive part of that accomplishment is just longevity.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, you know, that's the thing is, he won a lot of games at Army, which was hard to do, and he's won a lot of games at Texas Tech, which is hard to do. And one of the other things Knight said on Wednesday night when he set that record was he noted the hoo-ha that accompanied Joe Paterno coaching in his 500th game at Penn State during the bowl season and said, you know, he had his 500 years ago, decades ago, and that, you know, there's as much pressure game in and game out on basketball coaches as there is on football coaches, and that, you know, basically that was his way of saying that, you know, he's put up with a lot of pressure and a lot of stress over the years, and he's still winning, and I do have to give him credit for that.
All right, let's move on to some of the other basketball teams we should be considering. A trio of undefeateds topped the men's rankings, North Carolina, Memphis, and UCLA. You mentioned the last time we spoke that Memphis, currently number two, was your favorite to cut down the nets at the end of March Madness. Is that still the case?
Well, you know what, I'll stick with that, but to me the most impressive team we have seen so far is Kansas. They have been dominant. They haven't had a close game in a month. They lead the nation in scoring margin. They're very deep, and in what has become the year of the freshman, they have no freshmen in their top eight players. They've got six juniors and seniors and a couple of very talented sophomores, and it's really, you know, impressive in this day and age to have that many upperclassmen who can really play. They're very good on defense. They're very good on offense. They run when they can. But the question is, you know, are they going to do it in March? Because Bill Self at Kansas has really not gotten it done in tournament time. He's had two first-round losses and a round of eight upsets, and this has got to be the year that he hits the payoff and makes the Final Four.
Well, obviously, being able to play different styles helps. Having great players helps. The tenacity you're talking about. Memphis may no longer be your favorite, but they may have the easiest schedule among the remaining unbeatens. Do you think they'll have an unblemished record heading into the tournament?
I think there's a very good chance of it, probably the best chance we've had in a long time. Illinois took it down to the last game of the regular season in 2005 before they finally lost a game, and I think that Memphis could go further than that and could be undefeated on Selection Sunday because they're playing in a league that they completely dominate, Conference USA. There's really nobody in there that's going to challenge them. Maybe road games against UAB and Houston, but those still should be strongly in Memphis's favor. They do have a couple of interesting non-conference games left against Gonzaga and against Tennessee, but they're both in Memphis, so that gives them an edge there. Maybe they drop one, but I would not be surprised to see them, I think it would be 31-0 going into the Conference USA tournament, win three games there, it'd be 34-0, and that would really, I think, put all the pressure in the world on them. I think a loss would benefit them at some point in time.
The Memphis Tigers are led by first-year guard Derrick Rose. He's part of a freshman class with Kansas State's Michael Beasley, USC's O.J. Mayo, and Indiana's Eric Gordon that's been hailed as one of the best heading into this season. Have the kids been as good as advertised?
Absolutely. Right now, Michael Beasley leads the nation in rebounds. Eric Gordon's averaging 23.5 points per game for a very good Indiana team. Kevin Love, I believe, is averaging a double-double for UCLA. Mayo leads USC in scoring. Derrick Rose has made Memphis, you know, that much better. It's the best freshman class I can remember seeing, and, you know, that's just really scratching the surface. Nick Calathes at Florida, DeJuan Blair, who really didn't get any pub, has been a big factor at Pittsburgh. You can go on and on and on around the country. The depth in this freshman class is amazing. The question is, how many of them will ever be sophomores?
We got about a month of conference games before the real jockeying for spots in the NCAA tournament begins, Pat. Which teams that haven't done much up until now do you think might start to distinguish themselves from here on in league play?
Well, you know what? I would look probably at Louisville in the Big East, which was a top 10 team coming into the season, has fallen out of the rankings, had some very disappointing losses, but has kind of been piecing things back together. They had injuries early, and they're overcoming those now. I think if you look around some other places, Wisconsin is coming on in the Big Ten. They really weren't that highly thought of coming into the season after losing a couple star players, but off to a quick start there. And Bo Ryan, a very steady, successful coach in that league. And then Pittsburgh maybe in the Big East as well is a team that's had bad injuries, lost Mike Cook for the season, has LaVance Fields overcoming a broken foot, see if he gets back in time for the tournament, but they pulled a big upset over Georgetown at home and showed that they're not going away anytime soon.
Pat Forty covers college basketball for ESPN.com. Pat, thank you again.
My pleasure, Bill.
On Tuesday, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig and Donald Fehr, director of the Players Association, appeared once again before Congress. Much of the hearing was given to celebrating the achievement of Senator Mitchell, whose report apparently delighted the legislators. But at one point during the hearings, Danny K. Davis, a Democrat from Illinois, asked what Selig and Fehr would do, quote, as a team. It was a question that struck both Mr. Fehr and Mr. Selig as bizarre.
Congressman, in all the years I've been in baseball and in the 30-odd years I've known the commissioner, I don't think anybody has ever previously referred to us as a team, either actual or potential.
Will they again, probably.
On a more serious note, Commissioner Selig maintained that baseball's new investigative unit, the formation of which he announced last week, would fill the need Senator Mitchell's report had identified.
They are to track every possible rumor so that nothing escapes us, and that will be their primary and really sole responsibility.
Mr. Fehr was not so sure of that.
One of the difficulties I have in responding is I don't yet know what the department is going to do. I don't know what techniques it's going to follow. It's my understanding that the protocols have not yet been developed.
Perhaps Mr. Fehr is right, and the protocols have not yet been developed. But perhaps it's not so hard to imagine how baseball's new Special Investigations Unit will operate. In organized baseball, the men and women charged with the responsibility of combating the perception that the national pastime is riddled with cheaters, frauds, and liars is known as the Special Investigations Unit. Not yet.
Sorry.
The following is a dramatization of the sort of work in which baseball's Special Investigations Unit, which includes a tip line, will doubtless be engaged. Now!
Just a minute.
Baseball's Special Investigation Unit tip line, Inspector Louise Costello speaking. You can call me Lou.
Inspector Costello? Lou Costello?
Yes.
That's pretty funny. Who's on first?
What?
No, what's on second?
How can I help you?
Yeah, Jose Canseco's dirty. He used steroids. I thought you should know.
We do know. He wrote a book about it. Everybody knows.
Then how come he's still out there making irresponsible allegations about upstanding players like Alex Rodriguez? How come Canseco's not in jail? What the heck kind of investigations unit are you?
We're baseball's Special Investigations Unit.
What was that? Are you recording this call?
Bud, did you push the button on your phone? This guy wants to know if we're recording his call.
Bud? Bud Abbott?
Who is this?
It's Alex Rodriguez.
Who's this Alex Rodriguez?
Alex Rodriguez, Hemingway, Shakespeare, Washington, Lincoln. And I never took any steroids, no matter what Jose Canseco says about me. In case he mentioned a Mr. Washington Lincoln.
He didn't.
So you won't be investigating me?
No, Mr. Lincoln.
Oh, boy.
Well, he sounded like a nice fella. Baseball Special Investigations Unit tip line, Inspector Costello speaking.
Hello, Lou. This is Bud Selig. You guys turn up anything yet?
Who did you say you were?
Bud Selig.
Trace this call.
I can hear you, you idiot. And you don't have to trace the call. It's the commissioner.
Guy thinks he's the commissioner. I think he's on something. Something stronger than flaxseed oil.
What the devil are you on about?
Okay, buddy. If you're the commissioner, explain the infielder's fly rule.
Well, by and large, infielders fly under the radar. We're interested in home run hitters and pitchers. That's our story anyway, in case anybody in Congress should ask about infielders, by and large.
What about large infielders?
Have you guys turned up anything?
Nothing. The current policy is working brilliantly, sir. Baseball's clean.
Well, that's some fine police work, Lou.
And so, organized baseball's concerns about performance-enhancing drugs are relegated to the past, where they can't threaten current and future revenues. The Congress comes across as concerned, the commissioner is responsive and responsible, and our heroes can take a vacation.
You have reached baseball's Special Investigations Unit. Just say no. That's what we do when anybody asks us if there are still drugs in baseball. Buy your ticket and have a nice day out at the old ball game.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Serena Williams was temporarily puzzled during the Australian Open when she was asked what she thought about a TV commentator who had indicated his admiration of her sister's posterior on the air during a slow-motion shot of Venus at play. Once posterior had been explained, Serena said, "Oh yeah, we say booty." Then, delighted at the new word she'd learned, Serena began giggling and said, "I'll try to keep that in the back of my mind. What are you doing? I'm shaking my posterior." Eventually, she regained her composure and said, "Venus definitely has a great posterior. I'm sure it looked nice." I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the long and allegedly lucrative coattails of Reggie Bush when he was a college football player. But first, the San Diego Chargers face an intriguing challenge tomorrow. Can they become the first team to defeat the New England Patriots this season? Joining me now to discuss that possibility is Jim Trotter of Sports Illustrated. Jim, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
The year began poorly for new head coach Norv Turner in San Diego. His team's 1-3 start included a 24-point loss to the Patriots, and it got so bad that Turner, who many felt was a mediocre coach before the year started, was openly mocked by fans and by the media as well. I gather that nobody's mocking him now.
No. They're ready to throw a parade for him now. So he's done what Marty Schottenheimer couldn't do here, and that's win not only one playoff game, but win two. And he did it last week with, a number of key players hobbled or out. So, no, people are feeling pretty good about him right now.
Well, those key players that you mention are, of course, running back LaDainian Tomlinson and quarterback Phillip Rivers. They were out for most of the game last week, having been injured early. What is the status of those two, and can the Chargers compete with the Pats if Tomlinson and Rivers are not at full strength?
Well, Tomlinson and Rivers both say they expect to play. Antonio Gates, the tight end, we just don't know about. He'll be a game-time decision. They need all those guys to beat New England. You're not going to beat New England with your backup. So if those guys are able to go, I think that they, the Chargers have the talent to hang with them, into the second half. I think ultimately New England will pull away.
There's a chance that San Diego will face the New York Giants, led by quarterback Eli Manning, in the Super Bowl if San Diego gets past New England. In 2004, Manning refused to sign with the Chargers, who had planned to draft him number one overall, prompting the Chargers to trade the pick to the Giants for the rights to Phillip Rivers. Would a win for the Chargers set a new world record for the ultimate ringing of irony?
It could. It was that moment still hasn't been forgotten here in San Diego. And, I can safely say that the Manning family does not get Christmas cards from anyone in San Diego. But that being said, and I've written this and I still contend this, at the time that Eli did what he did, if I were in his shoes, I probably would have done the same thing. We're talking about an organization that had had 8 straight years without a winning record. But the folks here in San Diego still take it as a slap in the face, and they have not forgotten it.
Jim, just to finish up, based on what you have said so far here today, it sounds like you might be a guy who would be taking the points and going with San Diego, not to encourage anybody to behave foolishly with regard to this game.
No, I don't bet, but if I were a betting man, I would take the points and San Diego. I think San Diego's defense matches up pretty well with New England's offense, and I don't think that San Diego is going to give up the big plays. I think they're going to do, to some extent, what Jacksonville did, and that's make the Patriots drive the field, eat up time on the clock, and just prevent them from going downfield. I think the Patriots win, but I think it's closer than people think.
Jim Trotter covers the NFL for Sports Illustrated. Jim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, you're welcome.
The guy most people outside the New York area have considered the other Manning will be in action tomorrow for the New York Giants when they play the Green Bay Packers for a berth in the Super Bowl. Joining me now to discuss Eli Manning and the cast of characters he hopes to lead to glory is Harvey Araton of the New York Times. Harvey, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Quarterback Eli Manning was the Giants' number one pick back in 2004. Expectations were that he would be even better than his older brother Peyton. That has not turned out to be the case so far, but is it the case starting now?
Certainly Eli has made tremendous progress the last 3 weeks, beginning with the game against New England at Giants Stadium and the two playoff games that the Giants have played. But you look at the two games that the two playoff games, and both were in climates that were more conducive to Eli's ability, his style. Eli has historically run into real difficulty when the conditions are not great. These conditions he's going to be facing in Green Bay are extreme, so I wouldn't tend to judge him harshly the other way should things not go well. But I think I will hold off on the declaration that he has arrived as a superstar quarterback.
Last year, the Giants were a bickering group of underachievers. They were quickly eliminated from the playoffs, and word was that Coach Tom Coughlin was widely disliked by his players and on the verge of getting fired. This time around, seems like the Giants' locker room is a very happy place. Is that due to success, or is the success due to everybody learning how to get along?
I think it's 50-50. I think that last year's team, the leaders of the team, seem to all have be pursuing their own agendas. And Coughlin, you know, was not a well-liked coach, you know, seemed to be something of a guy on an island. He definitely has become more approachable, a little bit more of a communicator. He'll never be Mr. Rogers, but he seems to have, you know, lightened up just enough so that the players could embrace him once the team started doing well. Now, something seems to have crystallized or galvanized his team, and my theory is that it happened in the 16th game of the season against New England when the organization and Coughlin essentially made a decision to go for the victory and in effect said, you know, we believe in this team. We are making a competitive statement. We're not just giving it away. And I think they kind of found something that night.
Well, in order to get the opportunity to play New England again, perhaps, in the Super Bowl, the Giants are going to have to get by the Packers. The Packers beat the Giants back in Week 2. They beat them 35-13 in New York. The Giants have improved, but so have the Packers. What are the chances the Giants win in Green Bay?
Well, obviously the Packers are, you know, a fairly substantial favorite and have to be playing at home. To me, I look at that part of the season, the Giants most significantly had no pass rush. In the Green Bay game, they had one sack, and that was kind of on a busted handoff. But they really put no pressure on Favre the entire game. And that's probably been the most significant evolution or transition for this team over the course of the season. They've really kind of redeveloped their pass rush. I think that's the key to the game. If the Giants can put pressure on Brett Favre, you know, he's been known to have mistake-prone big games in the past. And given the weather and, you know, given a potential pass rush, you know, it becomes a little bit more of a toss-up game, and I give the Giants a pretty good chance to win.
Harvey Ariton covers the Giants for the New York Times. Harvey, thanks again.
My pleasure.
I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. Reggie Bush, currently a running back with the New Orleans Saints, had an extraordinary college football career. He helped lead the University of Southern California to a national championship in 2004 and won the Heisman Trophy as the nation's best collegiate player in 2005. He was the second pick in the NFL draft in 2006, but for the past several years, Reggie Bush and his family have faced charges that they accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars and various other benefits from agents and would-be agents while Reggie Bush was still a college player. In Tarnished Heisman, a book released just this week, author Don Yeager contends that Bush did, in fact, break the NCAA's rules. Don Yeager joins me now from WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. Welcome back to Only a Game.
That's so great to be here again. Thanks, Bill.
Much of the material for the story you tell came from Lloyd Lake, a former friend of Reggie Bush's family. Lake and Lamar Griffin, Reggie Bush's stepfather, planned to establish a sports agency with Bush as the primary client. The deal soured, and now Lloyd Lake has sued Reggie Bush for almost $300,000. You acknowledge in an author's note that Mr. Lake was paid for his cooperation in producing Tarnished Heisman, your book. You're an investigative reporter. Why was it necessary to purchase Lloyd Lake's cooperation?
Well, let's start with the fact that the decision to purchase Lloyd Lake's story was actually made by Simon & Schuster before I was involved. Mm-hmm. I actually was not the writer until after that. I believe that the decision to make that call was because what Lloyd Lake held in his hands were some audio tapes that I think we'll probably get to talking about in a little
you
bit,
can bet on
in which he actually did record conversations between himself, Reggie Bush, and Reggie Bush's father He did so at a time when he realized that that the deal was falling apart. When Lloyd Lake played those tapes for folks from a couple of different publishing houses, they had a great level of interest in that because it was the first hard and fast verbal evidence, forget the paper and the other things that we were able to come up with later, that Reggie Bush had in fact was acknowledging that he was taking cash.
Lloyd Lake himself might reasonably be characterized as a career criminal. He served time for drug charges, domestic assault, violation of parole. What led you to conclude that he was a reliable source?
Clearly, as I say in the author's note to the book, we would all love when we're doing stories to have Mother Teresa as our source. She's not available. And in this particular case, it was a story of two people who were both admittedly doing something wrong. Mm. And in fact, if you read the book, we lay bare Lloyd Lake's career as a criminal. The key to this project was that Lloyd Lake would have no editorial control.
Mm-hmm.
Lloyd Lake read the book for the first time last week.
You maintain in the book that Reggie Bush was, quote, probably the highest paid amateur in college football in 2005. How much money from Lloyd Lake and others went to Bush or to members of his family while he was still playing for USC?
We can come up with about just around $300,000. I think the number is $291,000 that over that last 18 months that he was at USC went to Reggie or his family in the form of rent-free home, washers and dryers and appliances and furniture for that home, and all of which the Griffins took when they moved out of the home, a car that was purchased for Reggie Bush, a vintage Impala, a beautiful car that actually became the car that he drove back and forth to campus during his Heisman year, yet no one seemed to notice that he was driving this car. Yeah, the number approaches $300,000.
One of Lake's associates in the sports agency that he was trying to create was a man named Michael Michaels. Reggie Bush and his representatives have settled with Mr. Michaels, paying him somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000. Why didn't they settle with Lloyd Lake as well and avoid what has become some very ugly publicity?
I think I could probably nail it down to two reasons, but there is an entire chapter in the book devoted to this question because it's one that can only be answered by Reggie Bush's people, and they refuse to discuss this subject with us. Number one, Michael Michaels is a respected leader of a very significant Indian tribe in Southern California. The backing of that tribe was going to help make this whole thing come together. I think he's such a respected man that I think the sense was, let's pay him. If he came out and said that this was true, he would be the kind of guy that people would believe. Now, Lloyd Lake, on the other hand, you know, there's a guy who, you know, as Reggie Bush's attorney has mentioned on a number of occasions, is nothing but a felon. He says it over and over again. And I also don't think they knew that Lloyd Lake had these tapes. I think they were figuring that no one would ever believe Lloyd Lake.
When he was courting Reggie Bush as a potential client for his fledgling sports agency, what made Lloyd Lake begin to think that Bush and his stepfather and the family were playing him for a sucker?
These families were very close. Lloyd Lake's family, Reggie Bush's family, they're all from San Diego. Lloyd Lake actually played basketball at the same high school Reggie played football at a few years earlier. And suddenly, as things were progressing, it was getting down to D-Day when Reggie had to make a decision. Thanksgiving dinner was scheduled, and everybody was supposed to have Thanksgiving dinner together, and Reggie's parents and Reggie didn't show. And that was the sign that told them, as they sat around Thanksgiving dinner, the Lake family, that, uh-oh. And now, it wasn't just Lloyd's money. Lloyd's mother had dipped into her retirement fund to help make this happen. Lloyd's sister had reached into her bank account to make it happen. Everybody was chipping in because they all believed that this was, you know, this was the mother load. This was Reggie Bush, the greatest player in college football, who was going to become their business partner. When they saw that, that's when the decision was made for that Lloyd would start tape recording conversations.
My guest is Don Yeager, author of Tarnished Heisman. You're listening to Only a Game. The book strongly suggests that as a college player, Reggie Bush was getting money not only from Lloyd Lake and from Michael Michaels, but also from Michael Ornstein, who eventually became one of Reggie Bush's representatives. To what extent is this sort of thing just business as usual among promising college athletes?
You know, I did an interview earlier with a couple of former USC football players who are now working in the media. And they talked about, you know, hey, all these things, they happen. You know, the free steak out here and the $100 handshake there. I think what struck me about this is that this is more than the coach at the University of Hawaii made coaching football that year. That's such a big number that it just smacked of arrogance. You know, again, they move into this home, and as the concrete in the driveway was drying, Reggie Bush's parents wrote their name in the driveway. I mean, of a home that they're moving into.
They were entitled as far as they were concerned.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was a part of that that just smacked of arrogance. And I think that's what made this such a powerful story. And then on top of that, the fact that he was maybe the greatest player in college football that year.
If it's legally established that Reggie Bush was paid by Lake and others when he was still playing college football, would Bush face any penalties beyond perhaps having to give back the Heisman Trophy?
Well, the wild card in all this is the IRS. You know, hey, there's an amount of money here that that changed hands that something tells me wasn't declared on income taxes. That's a wild card. But beyond that, I don't think there's anything out there that the NCAA can sanction USC if they believe that USC knew or should have known. The NCAA can sanction Reggie Bush by declaring him ineligible, wiping away his records. But, you know, some would argue Reggie probably doesn't care about that.
All right, Lloyd Lake has made his allegations, and Reggie Bush and his representatives and his family have denied those allegations, and they have refused to talk to you. What happens next?
I think the NCAA will put pressure on USC to make Reggie Bush available for some kind of an interview. I think that they'll do their best to try to suggest that Reggie Bush is a representative of the university's athletic interest, and that as long as his Heisman Trophy sits there in the athletic department lobby and his records continue to stand, that USC needs to go to work to try to make sure that Reggie Bush answers these questions from the NCAA. And I don't think he'll want to do that.
Don Yeager is the author of Tarnished Heisman, Did Reggie Bush Turn His Final College Season Into a Six-Figure Job?, published by Pocket Books. He joined me from WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. Mr. Yeager, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much. It was awesome.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When he decided to rob the New Cumberland Federal Credit Union in Fairview Township, Pennsylvania last fall, Robert Colson Lavery made two bad decisions. First, robbing a bank is almost always de facto a stupid idea. Second, before entering the bank, Mr. Lavery attempted to disguise himself by smearing drywall compound on his clothes and face. The traditional silk stocking over the head might have been a better choice. No, three bad decisions, because the car in which Mr. Lavery made his getaway had a big Rusty Wallace NASCAR plate on the front. Hey, dude, if you want to fade into the crowd, get a Dale Earnhardt plate. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll go where the rain never falls and the sun never shines and the kids are giggling anyway. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Australian Open is underway, and it's not been without controversy. On Tuesday, WTA Tour Chairman Larry Scott said that five or six players have been approached in order to throw tennis matches, although he claims that no matches have been affected by gambling. Do we believe that
conclusion? Well, I was going to say, does this not sound like step one in the step three apologies to your fans to when it's determined that matches have been thrown? I think the notion that anyone bets on any kind of tennis is insane to me. I don't understand where the money is to be made, but apparently someone does.
On Tuesday, police resorted to the use of pepper spray at the Australian Open. What provoked that extraordinary measure? This wasn't a soccer game.
For the second year, there was hooliganism in the stands, apparently. Again, I mean, this is becoming epidemic around the world, the the use of what are perceived to be nonviolent crowd control techniques at the drop of a hat. They resorted to the spray because they feared for their safety when fans became aggressive towards them, having to fail to cut out what they described as offensive chanting. This is a police department that needs a little bit more work on crowd control technique.
In actual play at the first tennis Grand Slam of the year, Lindsay Davenport lost early. Has everything else gone pretty much according to form?
Well, yes, because Andy Roddick came to an open and is out in the early rounds, actually. America's Hope loses to Philip Kohlschreiber, the number 29 seed in the Australian Open, for your first big upset.
Former world chess champion Bobby Fischer died on Thursday in Reykjavik, Iceland, of kidney failure. How will you remember Bobby Fischer, Charlie?
Boy, you talk about one of the towering eccentrics in the history of American competition. It's impossible almost to explain to people who weren't there how big he was in the 1970s and how completely around the bend he went. He wound up essentially being deported and being taken in by Iceland, where, of course, he had his biggest moment, which was beating Boris Spassky in the notorious World Championship match in 1972.
The story regarding Kelly Tillman's insensitive remarks about Tiger Woods gained new life this week. Yesterday, Golf Week fired editor and vice president Dave Senor after the magazine ran a cover story this week about Tillman's remarks. The January 19th edition featured the photo of a noose on the cover. Gee, why am I not surprised that guy was fired?
Yeah, you know why he was fired? Because the PGA wants this to go away, and this was a violation of the policy of making what Kelly Tillman goes away. This is a disgrace to me. This is exactly what people were talking about when they criticized Kelly Tillman, who people are still defending, by the way, even though she's so transparently ignorant she shouldn't be allowed anywhere near a microphone except to perhaps change the sneeze guard. And this guy puts it out there for the world to see, and Tim Fincham has a hissy fit, and this guy gets fired.
Charlie, I had anticipated asking you how you thought Manning would do in the conference championship game tomorrow. However, I thought it would be the other Manning in the other conference. Do we like Eli, the New York Giants?
Eli's coming. Hide your heart.
Right, you are?
This is an interesting moment for Eli because for years, he was always the Tom Brady type among the two brothers. He isn't the kind of renegade downfield bomber that both his brother Peyton and his father Archie were. And I think he tried to live up to the family name and live up to being the first pick in the draft and live up to be the guy who forced the trade from San Diego to New York and all of those things. And somehow halfway through the season, and maybe we have to credit Tom Coughlin, he has managed to play quarterback very confidently, very coolly, and without a lot of obvious ambition. And he's one of the reasons why the Giants are there.
I guess the dirty tricks associated with that game, Packers against the Giants, have already begun. Apparently, Eli Manning will not be able to watch his favorite TV program when he gets to Green Bay.
Yeah, WLUK, pronounced WLUK, in case you're interested, usually airs Seinfeld at 5:30 in the afternoon, a rerun. And it has decided not to. It's giving its viewers a choice of which Vince Lombardi documentary they want to watch.
Mm-hmm.
To me, if Eli Manning has forced Jerry Seinfeld off the air anywhere in America, he's already done more public service than most professional football players.
In the AFC Championship game that will not involve the Colts, the Chargers will visit the Patriots. According to a computer simulation that I ran across this week, New England will win.
Really?
What do you think?
A very smart computer. I think that New England will win by a considerable margin. I think this game will be over perhaps by midway through the third quarter.
In baseball news, the owners were apparently delighted with Commissioner Bud Selig's performance before Congress on Tuesday. What about you?
Well, I mean, he's managed to, allegedly at least, put steroids in the past. And baseball is moving forward and all of this other things. And he's done the owner's bidding, so they extended him for 3 years.
I guess it's fair to say that the new president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, John Fahey, was not similarly impressed by Mr. Selig. Mr. Fahey characterized Mr. Selig's intention to keep baseball's drug testing program, quote, in-house as demeaning to Senator Mitchell. You go along with that?
No, just take out an ad, Mr. Fahey, please. We'll drug test for food. Go walk at an intersection somewhere with a sandwich board over yourself. This is WADA protecting its monopoly right to judge athletes, and I think baseball was well within its rights, and I applaud it for telling these people to essentially stuff it.
Marion Jones took her case to Oprah this week. Charlie, the rumor that Oprah has the authority to commute Ms. Jones' prison sentence, that's not true, is it?
I'm not exactly sure what this is all about. I don't think Oprah has a lot of standing within the federal court system. But I guess, you know, if you're appealing to the people to come back as a public figure once you've served your sentence in the hoosegow, there aren't many better places to do it than laying the foundation on Oprah.
Fans, coaches, and players the world over have been known to blame the officials for their problems, but Rob Malcolm, who's a defender for Derby County in the English Premiership, may have taken that excuse to new heights.
Okay, you don't like the ref, okay? The ref is probably wrong. The ref is probably every bit the incompetent you think he is. You go out and you have a couple of drinks afterwards, that's fine. You bore people in the bar with how much of a schlub this ref is, no problem. They're happy to see you. They'll get you your autograph. But being upset with a referee is no excuse for falling asleep in the middle of the street. It just isn't. Rob was found asleep in the wheel of his Range Rover in the middle of a motorway, the M1 specifically. Don't get in your car. Don't fall asleep. Go back into the bar and bore some more people about how incompetent the ref was.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
It's nice to be nice to the clergy.
Wales, that small country on a western peninsula of Great Britain, is known for a barely pronounceable language chock full of C's and G's and Y's, and a charming if inefficient affection for traffic circles on major highways. But in recent years, Wales has also become a destination for hiking, biking, rock climbing, windsurfing, land yachting, and many other outdoor adventures. So why would a country with so much to offer out of doors also be home to Great Britain's first indoor artificial cave? Only a Game's Karen Given couldn't resist finding out.
Henry Smith.
Henry Smith.
Gaina Pritchards snaps photos of a church youth group from Tunbridge Wells in Kent who've traveled to Wales as a coming-of-age adventure. Gaina leads this trip every fall with Henry, who, incidentally, doesn't smell. Although she's lived for decades in Kent, Gaina grew up in Wales and looks forward to bringing the kids here every year.
You know, kids go to Spain these days and Greece and all these far-flung places. But, you know, this is virtually on our doorstep and it's so beautiful and it challenges them. You know, it does. It's a big challenge for some of them.
While in Wales, the kids hike in the mountains and visit the coast. And every year they stop by E2 Adventures in Trelewis, just a half hour north of the capital city of Cardiff, to try their hand at caving, or spelunking as it's called elsewhere. Gaina was a spelunker in her younger years. She sees the day's hour and a half long adventure as a way for kids to get a sense of the sport and see if they like it.
That's right, and perhaps they won't, but they've done it this once and they found out that they don't like it. They wouldn't know that, would they, unless they tried. Yeah.
The caving system looks out of place in the Adventure Center's picturesque backyard. A box-shaped gray concrete building, it barely seems big enough to hold a dozen giggly teenagers, let alone keep them busy.
164 metres in total, twists, crawls, squeezes. You could quite easily go for 2-2.5 hours and there no problems at all.
I stand corrected by Matt Parrott, the activities manager for E2 and guide for today's cave adventure. He also quickly corrects me on the notion that Wales needs more caves.
South Wales has got masses and masses of caves. Depends really on what you're after, whether you're after sort of water caves that you can dive or masses of cabins that you can walk, abseil, crawl through.
Well, if there are such great natural caves around here, why do you need a fake one?
Convenience, I suppose. And to be honest, it's really good. It's getting more and more popular. Initially, we had, you know, a few groups in there, and everyone was a little bit sceptical about a man-made cave. But now we're actively using it quite a bit, which is really good.
Matt says it's a lot easier to talk a caver out of a tight squeeze when they know the danger isn't real. And if anyone ever really got stuck, Matt could always just take the structure apart to get the unfortunate soul out, right?
I hope not anyway. It'd be an expensive job, that. We leave them in there before we do that, I think.
Okay, well, wrong again. And on that note, it's time to suit up and go on in. Matt opens up a room-sized equipment locker and starts handing out red and blue thick canvas suits. We're told that they won't really keep us dry or warm, but they will keep the worst of the mud and gunk off our street clothes.
Velcro on the inside, guys. So literally step into them, zip them up. If you can arrange yourselves, guys, come over the shortest people at the front, going to the tallest.
13-year-old Johnny Walter declares himself the shortest without much competition. He doesn't seem to mind being the only one who has to wear a child-sized suit or having his fingernails painted by the girls in his group. But he does have big expectations for the adventure ahead.
I've been in a cave before, but I've never been underwater in a tiny cave before.
And you think you're going to go underwater?
Well, I hope so.
So what do you hope there's in there? What do you want to see?
I'm not really sure. I just hope that it's really small and tight and wet. I like it.
I want to see a dragon.
I'm sure there are loads of dragons. It's whales.
Yeah.
For the record, there are no dragons in E2's artificial cave, and the water has been drained for the winter. But we're assured that there will be plenty of adventure nonetheless.
Cool. I'm absolutely shocking, guys, at remembering names. So we'll have Matt. Doris, Barbara, Daisy. We've got Tom already. Cool. Right, guys, come on. Let's wander in.
We walk upright through the first passage, which we'll soon learn is a rare comfort. I've never been in a real cave, but this structure seems to simulate one in every way. The concrete has been molded to resemble rock that's been cut through by water. It's dark, cold, and more than a little bit damp. After just a few twists and turns, we come out into what's been described as a great big room, a chamber smaller than many people's bathrooms. Almost immediately, Matt puts the crew to work.
We're in the main chamber, okay? This is one of the rooms that everything sort of interlinks to, guys. So what I want you to do, without going too far down the tunnels, I want you to have a little look around and work out how many ways in and out there are.
As the group counts the entrances and exits, I start to worry. This cave might be fine for a bunch of skinny kids from Kent, but other than the entrance I just came through, I can't imagine squeezing through any of these passageways.
How many have you got, guys?
Four.
I count five. Look again.
I count five.
The fifth entrance is the smallest of them all, obscured by a big boulder. Making it through that space would require a body contortion that I'm sure is not possible for anyone over the age of 15. Luckily, Matt does not choose that route for our first foray.
This passage, you're going to need to get down onto your chest. Oh. So Superman style, guys. Arms out in front, a little bit of crawling. The passage, guys, isn't that big, and you're back in a massive room like this, okay? So, well done, Barbara. Off you go.
It's uncomfortable, to be sure, and wet, and gritty, muddy, and a little bit slimy. But true to his word, Matt meets us in just a few minutes in another massive room that's not so massive, where large man-made stalagmites are joined by smaller, natural stalactites, which are growing at super speed, fed by the nutrient-rich concrete walls. Matt explains later that it's just one of the things that has surprised the builders of this cave since it opened 8 years ago.
We budgeted to have fake stalactites and fake stalagmites put in, but it was a complete and total shock to see natural ones growing. And for me, I worked just so long, I was here when the cave was built, so it's nice to see things progress.
Matt instructs everyone to sit down and turn off their headlamps. For a few moments, the group sits in total darkness and complete silence.
Oi, don't slap me!
Well, almost complete silence. What do you expect from a group of 13 and 14-year-olds?
Okay, can you imagine navigating in the dark, guys?
No.
Would you find your way out?
Yeah.
No.
No.
No?
Maybe.
No.
Yes.
No.
No.
Right. Little exercise. Leave your lights off for now, guys. We're going to leave the next bit, guys, in the dark completely.
Oh, no.
As instructed, we turn off our headlamps, crawl along the hard, damp ground, and follow a somewhat slimy rope through some of the tightest twists and turns we've encountered yet. Finally, we're back in the main chamber, after coming through that same hole blocked by a boulder that seemed impossible before. We've also collected our fair share of scraped palms, bruised knees, and strained muscles. But while Barbara, or is it Doris, just wants it to be over, most of the group happily streams outside to enter the cave from the top. During the summer months, this entrance would be completely flooded, with just enough air for the cavers to breathe while they wait for those in front to slide down the waterfall. But thankfully, today it's relatively dry.
What's going to happen is you're going to slide down, you're going to hit the ledge, okay? When you hit the ledge, you're going to sit on your bum, slide forward, and then you're going to see a gap in the water by this big. Head first through there, and you're back in the main chamber.
Okay. Like the walls of the cave, the danger is simulated. Matt pretends that the ledge is really small, or only on the right side, or not there at all. The truth is, the ledge is just out of reach, and the kids must take a leap of faith, letting go and dropping a few feet into the inky dark.
You can do it first.
Keep going. Oh my God, he's dead. Okay, Chris, sit down and slide forward. Okay, up you go.
Just as they're falling, Matt tells each caver that they've missed the ledge, and every single one of them falls for the joke. At the end of the hour and a half, many of the kids are ready to try caving again. Others very politely explain that they feel no need to come back. In that way, the cave did what it was supposed to do, separate the spelunkers from those who prefer to keep their feet on dry land.
Keep going. Okay, sit your bum and slide forward.
A card-carrying member of the second category, for only a game, I'm Karen Given in Trelewis, Wales.
Oh my God, it's like...
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Ken Smith at WFSU in Tallahassee. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's indoor caving photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from youth group leader Gaina Pritchards, who approves of the indoor cave facility in Wales and the people who constructed it.
Actually, the Yorkshire Cave, as I understand, that built the system originally got stuck in it themselves. So that's good recommendation.
Actually, the laughter aside, that would be a bad recommendation. Nothing funnier than getting stuck in a cave. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.